Hey there, MuggleCast listeners! I am back to inform you of some excellent news. GoDaddy.com is having better deals than ever. For only $3.59 a month for 12 months, you can get GoDaddy.com's Economy Package. And with 250 gigs of bandwidth, 5 gigs of storage, and up to 500 email accounts, you can get your own website up and running with success. And as usual, enter code MUGGLE, that's M-U-G-G-L-E, when you check out. Save an additional 10% on any order. Some restrictions apply. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.
This week's podcast is also brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/mugglecast today for details.
Because we have lots of unanswered questions, this is MuggleCast episode 128 for January 19th, 2008.
You guys seen our brand new Wizard Rock section on MuggleNet?
I have.
I'm going right now, Andrew.
I must say it's very impressive.
MuggleNet.com/app/rockband/home is the universal resource locator. It's our brand new section with over 160 rock bands.
Yay!
Really?
Yeah.
Jeez,
do you guys like it?
Yeah.
I made it all by myself.
It's really, really cool, but...
Thanks.
From what I can tell, there's something missing, isn't there?
There is one group that is not listed on that site.
There is one band missing. It's my Wizard Rock band, but...
Oh, well, that's probably
I decided for the best. I decided that the Wizard Rock section on MuggleNet was actually going to have the worst rock bands, and mine's or Wizard Rock bands, and mine's too good for it.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
I don't want to blow everyone away. I don't want to steal the limelight from great bands such as the Remus Lupins, the Moaning Myrtles.
Well, I was just thinking about that one time at Prophecy when you were supposed to perform, and you never did. You know, and
I
we
did.
Had to peer
yes,
we
I
had
did.
To peer pressure you into doing a chorus at the live Leaky Mug.
Because it's hard. It's hard to do a rap
a
cappella.
Yeah, whatever.
It was a lot of pressure. There was a big audience. Anyway, we have a good show for everyone today, including chapter by chapter, and we're going to bring favorites back, and we also have a couple little announcements. I'm Andrew Sims.
I'm Eric Skull.
I'm Laura Thompson.
I'm Micah Tannenbaum.
And I'm Matt Britton.
Micah Tannenbaum's in the MuggleCast News Center with the past week's top Harry Potter news stories. Hey, Micah.
All right, thanks, Andrew. 4 months in development on Wednesday night, MuggleNet released its latest project, MuggleNet's Wizard Rock section. With over 160 bands in our database, fans can read interviews, listen to samples, write reviews, and more. It's the perfect place for fans to discover the fandom phenomenon that is the music genre of Wizard Rock. It was announced on Thursday that J.K. Rowling will deliver the keynote address at this year's Harvard University commencement ceremony on June 5th. University President Drew G. Foss was quoted as saying, "Perhaps no one in our time has done more than J.K. Rowling to inspire young people to experience the excitement and the sheer joy of reading. Her tales of Harry, Ron, and Hermione and their Hogwarts adventures have cast a spell on millions of readers around the world. Harvard isn't exactly Hogwarts, but I'm sure that her visit with us this June will be a moment of magic for J.K. Rowling's many admirers across the university." Finally, Timothy Spall, who played Peter Pettigrew in Prisoner of Azkaban and Goblet of Fire, has said he will reprise that role for the final two films. Small was quoted as saying, "I'm in the next one, and I'm also in the one at the end. I've a very big scene in that. I think they might be shooting two of them back to back. Hard to know, though, what with this writer's strike and all. They're shooting the penultimate one at the moment, which I have a brief appearance in it. I should be doing that soon." That's all the news for this January 19th, 2008 edition of MuggleCast. Back to the show.
All right, thank you, Micah.
You're welcome.
You know, I've described the news in the past like a roller coaster, and I'm sticking with it because this week we only really have actually we have two things to discuss. One news story just came out today, very briefly though. One big story we want to talk about that's been getting a lot of press, at least on the fan sites and even some British tabloids. Apparently, there are rumors circulating around now saying that the final Harry Potter book is going to be split into two films.
Yes. Yes.
And this was originally reported by the Daily Mail. And it says here in the article, "For filmmakers, Warner Brothers, whose first five Potter films have made $2.5 billion in box office receipts, it could mean a £500 million bonus in ticket sales because people are essentially paying for the same movie twice. They'll easily double their profits for the final film." Do you guys think this could come true?
Like, gee, why didn't they think about doubling their ticket revenue when they decided not to make any of the other movies into two parts?
Yeah, I mean, we've heard this same rumor a lot before. Didn't it come around with Goblet of Fire too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
It did.
It's true. And nothing came of that. No, Book 7's not even the longest book. It's shorter than, well, depending on what version you read, it's actually the third longest, I think it was.
I think the difference with the seventh book is that there's a lot more information in it that has to be covered. And
like what?
I think the difference with the seventh book is that there's a lot of information that they're going to be relying on that they haven't used in previous movies. So on top of the information that we got in Deathly Hallows, they're going to have to include a whole bunch of backstory that they never gave us in the other films to make it make sense.
Yeah.
So that would be the only reason I would see for them doing that. But honestly, I think we're just going to have a regular length movie like we always have.
It would be nice to have a two-part.
It would. I would love it.
Yeah.
But why? Why would they have not have done it first? I mean, there are so many other books I would rather be two-part movies than...
See, I'd rather it be the final film.
Yeah, it makes more sense.
Yeah. Why does it make more sense?
Because it's like the grand finale, you know? It's the end.
Right.
Well, and there's not much you can cut out in this book.
Yeah.
Except the months and months they're in the forest doing nothing.
Well, according to this article, it says a film source said, "There's so much to fit that the view is that the last movie should be in two halves. There's a huge battle when Harry, played by Dan Radcliffe, takes on Voldemort that needs to be done really well."
And this quote intrigued me as well because I was thinking, well, yeah, I mean, the Battle of Hogwarts, God, they could make that so good. You know, they could make that. But, I mean, they've got a battle at Hogwarts to do in movie six as well that they should probably turn into some kind of fruitfulness. But, I was thinking about that quote, because I had read it too, and I was thinking, well, then again, and I'm sure I've said this before, but when I first read the fifth Harry Potter book, which was after it came out June 20, 2003, when I first read it, I was thinking at the end scene, you know, the whole Department of Mysteries, etc., I said, wow, they could really make this alone an hour or two-hour movie. I mean, if you read that scene in the book, it's just the whole time, once they get to the Department of Mysteries, all the rooms they explore, up until the end of the book, you know, they could turn that into a really long period of time in the movie. And as we know now, they made it pretty short in the movie. They actually did successfully, they made it into a short clip, sort of part of the movie, and fit it into one film. So no matter how long you think no matter how long it's appeared to be written in the books, they can always condense it and kind of get away with it. And I just don't think that. I think it's not that cool that they should make the seventh book into two-part movie if they didn't make any of the other first six.
The other thing to note here is that a script hasn't even been written.
It's true.
Because Steve Kloves, he's part of the Writers Guild, so he can't start writing anything, which isn't too much of a worry now because, you know, Half-Blood Prince still doesn't come out till November. I would think he would, hopefully, if the strike ends soon, he would normally be writing a script, what, like maybe starting in a few months from now. Well, what's the time frame for that, man?
Because pre-production happens quite soon.
Yeah, it does. Most of the entire production is pre-production. In production of films actually are the shortest out of all the stages. They last for probably a month at the most, and that's it.
Okay.
Like, they film the movie in almost a month or 2 months' time.
Right? Oh, no, it takes a lot longer.
I thought with Harry Potter it took a lot longer.
I'm talking about filming. It takes hours and hours of pre-production before they film, I'm saying.
Okay, and
the actual filming.
Interesting. So, when do you think, like, would you think that they would already have a script for movie 7? I mean, the trio is only going to get older, you know, the longer they wait to...
No, I don't think they have anything written for movie 7.
Well, they don't, but
yet.
Would they? Should they, if it weren't for the writer's strike?
No. I still think it's too early.
For movie 7, I don't think so.
Okay.
Because they still have movie 6.
Yeah, how do I phrase this? I do think it is early enough for them to be considering putting the movie into two parts, because that is a big decision that I'm sure isn't just made by the writer or producer. I mean, that goes way up to the top of Warner Brothers, because that's essentially an eighth Harry Potter film.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that's an important discussion that if they are discussing, and I think it's worth discussing, then you know, it will take a lot of time to decide that. And I would imagine, don't you think they would have to decide whether it's going to be one or two parts before he starts writing anyway? Because he has to plan how long the script is going to be.
Well, usually they come up with drafts. Yeah. They do several drafts of a film, and if they think it won't all fit into a movie condensed version, then they would say – they would explore the possibility of two – I think, anyway. I mean – well, do you guys think that if they split it into two movies, they'd be called anything different? I mean, would they be Deathly Hallows Part 1, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2?
Yeah,
I think part of the problem, though, is that you have to take into consideration when these two would be released. Would they be released close to each other, or would they be separated out by a couple months, a year? Because that can cause some problems, I think, especially because of the flow of the movie, in the sense that, you know, Eric, you brought up before how you really don't think why this movie is special enough to warrant being split into two when there are other books that have come before it that could definitely have been split up as well. I know that may be prejudiced on the fact that you didn't really like Deathly Hallows maybe as much as some of the books that came before, but I still think there's a lot of consideration that has to go into this. And you know, coming from the Daily Mail, I know it's not a very reliable source, and even the comment that they had about being able to double their revenues, I don't really think Warner Brothers is very concerned with its revenues from the Harry Potter series, that they're going to need to really consider, you know, making up for anything by doubling the revenues. I really just think that that's an idiotic statement.
Mm. Well said. Mm.
Have they successfully done movies in continuum? I mean, I know Lord of the Rings was actually, you know, I mean, was all filmed at once. It was. And then they broke it up and did different production sort of years and years and years. I was thinking, though, of the Matrix trilogy with what you said, that they would possibly separate them by a few months. I think it was in 2002, in February and November, were the second and third Matrix released. The films were released then.
You run a risk, because where do you leave off in Deathly Hallows? People are going
to
want more right away.
It would have to be a huge cliffhanger.
Exactly.
You have to find the cliffhanger factor, because if non-Potter fans go and see the movie and they don't like where it ends, they're not going to see the second part. Unless a trailer or some other promotional device intrigues them. But I mean, I'm just thinking what kind of publicity nightmare it would be for Warner Brothers. I mean, you're releasing a two-part book. Everyone knows it's one part, but they're splitting it into two. I just see that as, like, you know, there's a, like, are there two premieres?
It's so much extra work, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And has it ever even been done before? This would have been, like, the first time.
Well, actually, movies used to be made quite successfully, especially movies made out of books. They were about 4 hours long. I'm thinking specifically of Gone with the Wind. But the way they were constructed was they actually had an intermission. They would show both parts,
right,
and you would leave the theater for 15, 20 minutes, come back and see the second part. So when I think of a film like this, that's the only way I can think of it being truly successful, is just running it all at once. But I don't really see why they do that anymore. it's really not that common.
Here's an interesting
story. They don't do that very much anymore because there's so many movies in production.
Which is true. But you know what else is interesting? They turned when I went and saw Chamber of Secrets in the theaters, they gave it an intermission because of the young children in the audience. The movie theater that I ended up working for after that put a little, 10-15 minute sort of intermission in between the movie, in the middle of the movie. They put the stop break for all the kids to go to the bathroom or whatever and not miss the movie. So they actually took Chamber of Secrets, which is only, 2.5 hours long, and they put an intermission in between that. So they did that for the Harry Potter film when it was only one film, which was
interesting. Well, I also think they might have to bite the bullet and just realize, hey, we need to make this movie longer than the six that have come before it. Not go to a 2 hour, 15 minute, 2 hour and a half movie. We're looking at something that needs to be over 3 hours long.
Yeah.
If you gotta give it that treatment, just make it make it one movie, but make it a longer movie.
Maybe
we're all blowing this out of proportion. Maybe they will do it like Gone with the Wind style and just give us an intermission. I mean, it doesn't happen anymore, but why not?
Because how long have we been trying to convince them or trying to say that a four-hour movie wouldn't mind?
Yeah, I can't think of anyone who would care, to be honest.
And plus, movie theaters would eat that up. If there was an intermission, that's extra food sales for them. I mean, everyone's going to run out and buy new soda and stuff.
Definitely.
It's true, and food is what people depend on, what movie theaters depend on, the concession sales.
Yep.
I don't think movie theaters will really object to it because... You know, they know they're going to make money off a Harry Potter film.
It's just less showtime. Well,
that's one thing. But
it's interesting news.
Yeah. So we'll wait to hear more confirmation. I mean, WB hasn't said much. The one thing that WB did go to Empire Online and told them that nothing's official yet. That's not a no. That's what gets me. I mean,
it's not a no.
Normally they would say no to stupid rumors, but saying nothing's official, nothing, I think they actually told Empire Online, or Empire Online just brought up the point that Steve Clovis can't write right now and he hasn't started.
Yeah.
But like I said earlier, they might need to decide whether to make it one or two movies before they start writing. At least a very final draft, so.
That's news to us, though. Writer's strike affects Harry Potter fans. Here's how. Yeah. I'm really tired of the writer's strike. I don't know about
you
guys.
Well, late-night shows are back, so that's all I care about.
What about The Office?
Of course. Yeah, that's a shame, but I was watching a rerun the other day, and it was nice.
What about the director talk? I mean, this seems like a lot of the same that we hear when every movie is considered who's going to be directing it, but...
Spielberg said he was.
No, it's in this article that Spielberg is one person being considered, and.
But I'm saying for the original film, didn't he? Wasn't there an interview we posted among that recently that said that Spielberg was in fact considered for the first film?
I think we've known that
for
a while.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah,
but he was giving his opinion on it or whatever, and that was cool.
He wanted to put American actors in it. I believe
that's right.
Well, it was an idea of his. It was an idea.
We'll move on to some other news, but I'm sure we'll be talking about it more unless it gets completely thrown out by Warner Brothers.
Which it should.
Yeah. Story that came out on Thursday. J.K. Rowling is going to speak at the Harvard commencement ceremony. She's going to be delivering the main keynote address. How cool is that?
That's really cool. Can you imagine having J.K. Rowling speak at, oh my gosh.
Your graduation of your commencement?
That would be amazing.
How amazing would that be, yeah.
Joe.
Why is she doing it?
I don't know.
They're giving her something, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They're giving her a one of those doctor degrees, I think. You know, that they give like all the famous people just for being famous.
Mm-hmm. like, J.K. Rowling can speak at my graduation, you know? Like,
it says the university will also grant Rowling an honorary degree at the June 5th ceremony.
Am I the only one here who's had a commencement address?
Yeah. Yes, you have.
None of us have graduated yet.
So far. But we're all in college, so that's good.
I think Joe should come to McDaniel College. We would happily welcome her there.
I would just love to see Laura. I would just love to see you.
I would probably just burst into tears at being so
happy.
I'll speak
at your commencement, Laura. I'll speak at your commencement.
Okay, Eric, you do that.
You know, what's really special about this is think how many times J.K. Rowling acts as a public speaker. I mean, besides her book readings, how many other times has she stood at a podium and
she's spreading out, man. She's totally spreading out. She's totally, now that she's done writing, she's got
more free time. Well, obviously, no. But what I'm saying is, this isn't her kind of thing. You know,
she's also mentioned that in the documentary.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah, that's where I was going. I mean, she doesn't even like doing this much, and you know, now she's doing it. So it'll be really interesting to see what she says. I'm sure she'll touch on her past life as living in a flat and being broke and all that. In other news, J.K. Rowling will be on Bugglecast next week, so make sure you tune in for that. so that's cool.
You're kidding, right?
Yeah, I'm kidding. No, I'm not. Yes, I am. Yeah.
We're pathetic. We're pathetic, Andrew. We're pathetic.
All right, so moving on to announcements now. It is a new month, and we're reminding you kind of late, but we are up in the top 10, and we thank everyone. But vote for us on Podcast Alley so we can get up as high up as possible because we like being high on that list.
Yeah.
Also, thanks
nine.
To everyone who...
We like being high on that list.
On the list, yeah. Thanks to everyone who sent us links to the online copies of the J.K. Rowling documentary. A lot of people sent these in. Someone did send me in a really good BitTorrent, though, and it downloaded nice and fast, and now I have it on my pewter. So if any of you guys want it, I'll forward it to you. So you can watch the documentary over and over again. But thanks to everyone who emailed that in. A lot of you did. Also, everyone here except Matt, in other words...
What?
In other words, Eric, Laura, Micah, and I are sort of kicking around the idea of doing a mini spring break East Coast tour come mid-March. Now we have to remind everyone that this is very early on in the planning stages. It might not happen at all, but we're looking into the possibility. We want to know how many people would actually show up. So, visit MuggleCast.com and we have 5 tour stops there. If you live on the, in New England, then, visit MuggleCast.com or even towards down Virginia, which isn't really in New England or Baltimore for that matter.
North of the line, people.
Yes.
North of the line.
Visit MuggleCast.com and vote for the location that you could attend, or vote and say that you can't attend. Take the poll seriously. Don't just vote for Philly just because you used to live there and it's your hometown and you're representing the area. No, just vote honestly. So we'll look into this more. If we do it, it'll probably be between March 15th and March 20th. And it would be a lot of fun. It'd be a nice little tour. And, you know, Laura and I were just talking the other day about how bad we want to go to Boston.
Yeah, so all you Bostonians, go out and vote, please, because I really want to go to Boston.
Yeah. We'd like to do 4 or 5 stops, and we'd be driving, and it'll be interesting to plan just because of where we're all living and how we're all gonna get to these places and stuff. But we'll figure it out. It'll be good. And then we're doing a podcast in Dallas, Texas, at Portis 2008, as we've told everyone, hp2008.org. So visit that site too. Sign up, register, and come to Portis, and we'll be there for Potter Podcast Palooza Pickles. We'd like to remind everyone again that today's podcast is also brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider in spoken word entertainment. Audible has over 35,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded and played back anywhere, just like MuggleCast. If you're into Harry Potter as much as we recommend checking out Twilight, a book we've discussed on MuggleCast a few times. You've heard from our listeners about it, now you can give it a try free on Audible. Just visit audiblepodcast.com/MuggleCast today to get your free audiobook. Once again, it's www.audiblepodcast.com/MuggleCast for your free audiobook. Okay, let's move on to Muggle Mail now.
Muggle Mail.
Who wants to take the first email? Who wants to read it?
Can I? Okay. First one's from Nathan Gard, age 14, from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Subject is Chapter 9. He says, okay, this is just something I noticed while listening to Chapter by Chapter last week and wanted to see what you guys thought about it. If spells are supposed to lift if their caster dies, like when Dumbledore's spell lifted off Harry in Half-Blood Prince when Snape killed him in, then why does Moody's tongue-tying curse remain on Grimmauld Place after Moody dies? Just wondering what you thought. Thanks, love the show. Bye.
Ooh.
What do you guys think?
I don't know. I'm still confused by this whole tongue-twisting
situation. Yeah, that whole concept really throws me off.
Is it technically Mad-Eye Moody's... Was it the... When they say Mad-Eye Moody's tongue-tying curse, do they mean that it's the one that he made, or is it the one that he did? Like, did he invent that curse?
No, he didn't invent it.
No, but he put the booby trap on Grimmauld Place to attack if anybody should come in, should it be Snape or whatever. They're wondering why it's still kind of there if once Moody died, because when you put a spell on something, it is removed. And I really don't have that good of an answer.
Yeah, I don't either.
Yeah.
Myself, because of the way that the Fidelius charm was broken on Grimmauld Place itself. I was going to initially argue that something would be different if you put a spell on a place, such as all of Dumbledore's defenses on Hogwarts, etc., would still remain up because they're sort of on Hogwarts, as opposed to being on Harry, like he was holding Harry still, and when he died, that spell went off, but that is flawed.
Right.
Because
the same thing happens.
Sure.
With the tongue-tying curse, it's essentially a spell that's been cast on a place. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a good question. I don't know that we have an answer for it other than it maybe is a little bit of a mistake.
Yeah.
Because it would make perfect sense that the spell would not have any after effect.
Yeah. So either it does or it doesn't sort of... Either spells put on places do or don't get removed when they die. And it's there's some contradictions in the books.
The same book,
because of the way the Grimmauld Place things. And I think we have a question later on in the show about that as well, the Fidelius charm and how it actually works.
Yeah. Let's move on. Next email comes from Val17 of West Covina, California. She writes, as soon as you guys mentioned the possibilities, a thought popped into my head. The curse was to be used against the person that killed Dumbledore, right? Maybe it only took into account the true killer of Dumbledore. Snape killed Dumbledore, but not directly. What I mean by this is that he didn't kill him for his own purposes. He was helping out Dumbledore. So the true killer of Dumbledore is the curse from the Horcrux that would have killed him if it wasn't for Snape. So she's saying that's how Snape got by, I guess.
I just think
Snape. So, what
Snape
is the curse supposed to do? Tongue
is smart
the
enough
or?
To get by. I don't think it has anything to do with.
Yeah, I think that's. I think Mike is right.
Some other explanation. I mean, give the guy some credit. I mean, he's pretty.
Yeah.
Smart
he's,
wizard.
He's smart enough to say, "I didn't kill you," or "Why'd you make me kill you?" He's smart enough to say the word "kill," which disables the whole thing.
Yeah.
Third one comes from Javed Mohammed, age 21, from Trinidad and Tobago. Ooh, nice place. Greetings from Trinidad again. I have a few comments about the chapter-by-chapter segment. You all said that Snape broke into Grimmauld Place yet remained unscathed. This may be, probably so, since he is an accomplished Occlumens and would be able to lie about who killed Moody, and block his thoughts if the spell detected untruths. Also about Hermione's homonym revelio curse, hominoids and hominoids are direct ancestors of the primate family, into which humans, Homo sapiens, also falls into. This may explain the use of the word homonym in the curse. Still loving the show and all the best for New Year. Javed Mohammed. Oh, and it's pronounced Javed. So Javed Mohammed. Awesome, Javed. Thanks for that. That's what we just said, that we just came to that conclusion then about Snape being that good a wizard. But then he reveals something very cool about homonym, which we talked about last week.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
All right, the next one comes from Kim, 19, of Houston, Texas. She says, "Hey guys, I really enjoyed your discussion of Jake Hare's documentary in episode 127. Actually, I thought the episode as a whole was brilliant. But in regard to the documentary, I just wanted to add that I wish they had filmed Joe signing the bust inside the hotel upon finishing book 7. It would have been interesting to witness or at least hear from Joe herself why she did it. I imagine it was rather spontaneous. Also, I'd like to comment on something y'all mentioned in chapter 9 discussion. I think Micah was right in saying Snape got in before Moody set the spell in Grimmauld Place. I'm not sure where I read or heard it, but I'm pretty sure that's how it happened. You might want to check me on that. Thanks for reading. I love the show, and I'm looking forward to anything y'all do in the future, HP related or not. Pickles, Kim."
Oh, Pickles.
It would have been nice to see her do this.
Yeah, I agree.
Maybe there's some concerns with showing vandalism on TV.
It raises some ethical concerns. It really, truly does. I remember the initial shock, when we all found out that our favorite JK, our favorite author, JK Rowling, was a vandalist or a graffitier.
I'm sure the hotel does not view it that way.
That's only because of how much more their hotel is worth now that JK Rowling signed the
bust. Because, if we went there and signed a bust, we would probably...
I'm pretty sure they'd kick us out. Yeah, with a fine. Yeah. With a fine. But since J.K. Rowling did it, no, I mean, it raises some questions. And you're right. If this documentary did follow J.K.R. as she was writing the book, it should have pretty much included that.
Maybe she did that by herself. Maybe she kind of wanted to have her own private thing to do when the cameras weren't rolling. You know?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah.
I think it was because it was illegal, and they couldn't legally tape it.
See, it's weird, because when she always wrote that, when she wrote that story about how, you know, she finished the book, and then she wrote into the Balmoral, wrote on the bust, I was always picturing it being like, it was a dark night, and, you know, it was,
alone.
She was alone, it was dark, it was a small little room, it was candlelit, but now that we see the documentary, you know, it's broad daylight, there's a crew in there, Jo's listening to, what's the song she listened to when she finished?
Something by a artist.
Okay, I really need to see this documentary.
I forget who.
Yeah. But I can't remember the song right now. But you know. But that's cool that she listens to some music afterwards. But yeah, whatever. I think there were just some concerns. Maybe Jo was doing that.
Ooh, can I read the next mail? Time. Can I read the next mail?
Yeah.
This one's from Ruth H, age 27, of Rapid City, South Dakota. She says, "Dear MuggleCasters, love the show. I'm a stay-at-home mom to a one-year-old, and every time I put on MuggleCast as an alternative to Dora or the Wiggles, my daughter dances to your opening music."
Aww.
Anyway.
That's so cute. Take video. Put it on YouTube.
Take video of, yes, please. And MuggleCast is a good alternative to Dora or the Wiggles. Anyway, my comment is in regard to your discussion last week of the Voldemort name taboo, and maybe this should wait till your chapter by chapter for 20, but whatever. Ooh, maybe it should. The trio does say the V-word pretty quickly upon arriving at Grimmauld Place, but nothing seems to happen, and Ron does tell Harry later that the name breaks protective enchantments, causes some kind of magical disturbance. Page 389. Doesn't it seem like even if the DE's Death Eaters in the Square couldn't see number 12, they would still sense the magical disturbance? Do you guys think this is just a Joe boo-boo? Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work. And Laura, you keep those boys in line.
I'll do that.
Ooh.
For sure.
Seems like a lot of boo-boos are surfacing.
Yeah, I know. The only thing I can think of, I mean, and we obviously all just read this chapter, so it's all pretty fresh in our minds. But Remus says that the Death Eaters are all stationed outside of anywhere associated with Harry.
Yeah.
But I was also thinking maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe there's some reason they can't get in, but they can still sense it, so that's why they're there.
Yeah, because they're confused. You know, they're like, well,
I still recall that there was a scene where didn't like either Harry or Ron went outside to get the paper or something, and they saw that there were Death Eaters outside the place, but they couldn't.
Ooh, I don't remember. I don't think that was in this chapter.
It's definitely to come, though. It's to come where they look out the window and they see somebody in the square.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Remus even says that he had to, like, apparate to the very first step so they couldn't see him. Get in.
Which is what they try to do, only unsuccessfully, when they're escaping from the ministry. Yeah. Which is cool. Kind of.
Yeah.
It would be really interesting to ask, you know, some more specific questions about how these couple of subjects were kind of confused about work. It all kind of seems to center around Grimmauld Place.
JKR, we're not done with you, Joe. We have questions. we need answers. We're Harry Potter fans. Come on. Yeah.
Okay. So let's jump right into chapter by chapter. This week we're just going to cover chapter 10. Doing this one a week thing, the show's slowly living longer and longer.
Pray.
Chapter 10, Creature's Tale. So, short summary. In this chapter, Creature tells a tale.
That was very enlightening.
That was that was a very brief summary.
Well,
I can totally tell you read it.
It's a very emotional chapter, especially towards the end, focusing around house elves. I mean, you really see the other side of house elves, the side that you just actually feel kind of bad for. So the first point that we wanted to bring up, and somebody put this in here, but I actually had it as my favorite quote, but I guess if it's a discussion point, we could just talk about it first. Right there on the first page, Harry wondered whether they had fallen asleep holding hands, speaking about Ron and Hermione. The idea made him feel strangely lonely.
Yes.
Now, this was nice, because sort of, you know, Harry feels a bit alone if Ron and Hermione are together. He's sort of the oddball out in terms of relationships, love life in this situation. Obviously, he does
feel like the third wheel.
Yeah. He's the go-to guy, but on the other hand, he doesn't have his life partner with him.
No.
So I thought that was kind of sweet.
Gonna leave her behind.
Yeah, I think it kind of highlights that separation, too. You know, how Dumbledore told him he could really only trust Ron and Hermione with this. And so it's like he leaves behind Ginny, who he loves so much, you know, but he can't tell her anything.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that there'd be a trio, you know. Harry has Ron and Hermione are both his friends, but yet they're also sort of becoming boyfriend and girlfriend right in front of him. And the fact that he wakes up and looks over and sees that they could have been holding hands is a really good sort of portrait of Harry. And his feeling, this open up kind of gives you some really good insight onto sort of how Harry views everything. And same with later on. This whole chapter, I think, is a very keen on Harry and describing sort of how he feels about things.
Yeah.
Well, I have a question for Laura regarding this. Do you think that the holding hands was a result of Ron's book? Or do you think it was a genuine holding hands thing?
Okay. Thank you for bringing this up, Matt, because I've actually gotten a lot of emails from people who are like, you don't know what you're talking about. At least he's trying. And, you know, I'm not refuting that point. Yes, I acknowledge that he was trying.
Well, first of all, he's a fictional character, so people should calm down just a little bit and back off.
Thank you for that. And also, you know, yeah, he was trying, but as a girl who has... It's the best way to put this.
Just think about how you want to say this.
Yeah, who has known men like this, and you're just like, don't do that, because you look at it and it gets very frustrating because you realize that they don't completely get it even though they're trying to, you know, and it's kind of frustrating as a reader. It's not like I'm saying that Joe shouldn't have written it that way or that I didn't enjoy it. I quite did, and. Frankly, there was really nothing to say that they had fallen asleep holding hands. Harry just thought it looked like they might have. And I think that's what was really interesting about the quote, because romance seems to be really high on his mind at that moment, because that's the first thing he thinks when he looks over. He doesn't think about anything else, about any of the journeys that he has ahead, the fact that they could all die. He looks over and he's like, oh, I wonder if they fell asleep holding hands. And I think it shows that he's kind of, I mean, it shows that loneliness. And it shows he's kind of depressed about leaving Ginny behind, so.
Yeah.
Well, it said earlier, Ron had a fit of gallantry and insisted that Hermione get the cushions or whatever. What was that about? Did it say that Ron was just... asserting that Hermione be the most comfortable, or?
Well, yeah, it's kind of like the whole, it's kind of like a lot of the old-fashioned beliefs, like guys are supposed to hold open doors for girls. Just, you know, those kind of things.
Are they? Am I off the hook for not doing that?
Have you ever commuted in New York City?
No, what I'm saying is it's just like, it tends to be when a guy is trying to impress a girl, he likes her to be the most comfortable, he doesn't like her to have to do things for herself.
But after a year or two of marriage or a few months of dating, whatever
the case. Yeah, it's like you sleep on the floor. You cow.
Yeah. Anyway. So, sorry to hear about your relationships, Laura.
Yeah, me too. Anyway.
Who put the next point in there?
Oh, I did. I was kind of bringing that up because I thought it was an interesting parallel, and you guys have heard me harp on and on about parallels.
I'm tired of it. I'm sick of it, actually.
Shut up, Eric.
Parallel once more, I'm going to hit you.
I don't care.
I'm going to mail a thing that hits you to the P.O. box.
I like parallels.
I think the parallels are awesome.
I know. They're cool.
See, fail, Eric.
They never meet.
Okay. Thank you, Matt.
Oh, so funny.
Yeah. So what I thought was really interesting about Harry wondering, you know, if Snape has searched the house, you know, he thinks about him with scorn. You know, anytime Snape is mentioned throughout this book, no one likes him. They all think he's bad. And I just thought it was a really interesting parallel to the first book, where throughout the whole thing, they think he's this bad guy. And in the end, he turns out to be good.
Yeah.
So that's really all I had to say about that.
Well, it is a valid point, too. That's interesting that Harry should, that you say Harry wonders correctly if Snape has searched the house. So interesting that Snape has been there and Harry can kind of detect that. I think that's pretty cool. But clearly, you know, with books being overturned and shelves and everything being searched through, you know, someone has been there in the house.
Right.
So what, Harry wakes up, he goes up a few steps and finds himself inside Sirius's bedroom? Or what was yeah. formerly Sirius's yes. bedroom? And inside Sirius's room. Now, there's a contrast in this chapter that exists between Sirius's bedroom and Regulus's bedroom. And as J.K. Rowling says, they couldn't sort of be farther apart. They're quite the opposite of each other as far as Sirius has hung all these Gryffindor banners. There are pictures of Muggle motorcycles and even bikini-clad Muggle girls, which I thought was funny.
Yeah.
In Sirius's room. So he wanted to emphasize his difference from his parents, et cetera, et cetera. And when they go into Regulus's room, there's all sorts of Slytherin pride and obviously a bunch of old newspaper clippings about the Dark Lord. So I thought that was cool, and I wanted to bring that up. But what do you think about the letter that that Harry reads?
It's depressing,
I think. The letter was sweet. It was a little...
Not the letter itself, just the scene, I think, was pretty depressing when you have him just sitting there reading it and... It seems like, you know, you kind of get a feeling of everything that he's gone through over the, yeah. you know, the past 16 or 17 years in his life and how lonely yeah. it's really been. It goes back to what Laura was saying, you know, at the beginning of the chapter, you know, with Harry and looking over at Ron and Hermione, it just reemphasizing just how lonely he has been, not just in recent years, but pretty much his whole life.
Well, this is the first time that Harry really notices that his mother... really lived.
She really wrote her, that her hand really, you know, wrote these words.
Yeah. This is the first time Harry actually touches something that his mother touched or
right.
created.
And that was a,
yeah, and I love
when herself.
Good.
Sorry, I was going to say, and that was a first for readers too. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but when I was first reading this book and we had the letter from Lily, I was like, whoa, it's really weird to read something from her perspective.
Yeah.
Because this whole time we've just known of her as someone who's dead. And then suddenly we have a letter from her.
She's his mom.
Weird.
You know,
yeah.
she died saving Harry, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We learn all this stuff about her to actually hear her writing and read her writing. It's actually quite cool. And, I mean, couldn't you guys just see the little baby Harry on the broom, on the toy broom, speeding
yeah.
around and everything? I think that was
I really,
so all cool.
I really hope that that's one of the things that makes the movie, because I would love to see that picture. And I think Dan Radcliffe could pull that off really well, making the realization you know, that the
what being a 1-year-old baby.
Yeah, they'd cast Dan Radcliffe
being
as
a 1-year-old
toddler.
No. Just looking at the picture, looking at the letter.
Yeah. Talk about pre-production.
No, I agree.
I agree. That was a very special
Dan Radcliffe
moment.
Is really striking me as a really good actor. Like I just like him recently. I've just really noticed how intense he can be. It's really cool.
Yeah,
that's all he can be.
Yeah,
you know, talking about the letter, I think probably the best quote I liked from this chapter was when they were talking about the G's that she made.
Oh,
and it said, each felt
yeah.
like a friendly little wave glimpsed from behind a veil. And I thought that was Jo just at her best.
Yeah.
Referencing
I
veil.
Love when Jo writes...
My mom wrote her G's.
I love when Jo describes that kind of thing. Makes things really... Personifies things, like even the letter G.
Well, and also the reference to the veil, too. I thought that was really great.
Yeah.
And she used the veil several times throughout the book, I remember reading, and she would describe something like it was beyond some kind of veil or something along those lines.
And yet we didn't hear from Sirius in this
it's because he's dead.
I know.
He's
I accept that.
Dead.
No, I do. But yeah, you're right. Oh, there were a lot of veil references. I was like, we're totally going to see that room again, aren't we? And then we didn't.
I know,
okay.
And I really wanted to, and I was so upset. But
next
anyway.
Next time. Book 8, Laura. You know.
Yeah, sure.
And what about Dumbledore in this letter? I mean, it just kind of reinforces Harry's mistrust in him.
This is one of those letters that really makes the plot. You know, it's these letters that just Harry happens to find in this book, not any, you know, previous book, but this book. And it's so important and it's so amazing and lovely. It's just one of those things that spurs the plot into action. And you're right. It totally reaffirms that there are some questionable things about Dumbledore.
Yeah. But she said it lightly, like it's not something like very... I would say negative. It's probably just one of those little
like,
secrets.
What's Dumbledore up to?
Yeah. Just like... Like, yeah. Dumbledore did this?
Yeah, but Harry's reaction was more anger, I think, than we've seen him previously. I think it's slowly building up.
I think it's partially because Harry doesn't know what exactly Lily was talking about. I mean, it could be. Could you believe Dumbledore donated so much to charity? Like, we don't know what it actually was.
Yeah, the second page is missing.
Right.
I mean, second Harry half. Finds it later after the fact, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. So we don't know what it actually, you know, is about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a
shame. So Harry is determined now to find.
Do you think? Real quick. Do you think Snape took it?
He did.
He did. Yeah. He did.
I was being sarcastic.
He's like, oh, okay.
Guys.
I thought. Well, you didn't sound very sarcastic.
Never mind.
Yeah. At one point in this chapter, they mentioned the tedious task of the Horcruxes, the difficult task that Dumbledore now laid out in front of him. Harry, I guess that's when Harry just woke up, and I'm thinking in retrospect. Was it really terribly difficult to locate the Horcruxes? I think they were very successful in doing so once they did, and it was thought it was all right. You know, I thought it wasn't that big of a deal necessarily.
Yeah.
But I think Hermione asked him if going to see Bathilda would really help search for the Horcruxes, and I think it did. But well, Hermione is.
I think it's ironic
skeptical.
That it almost gets them killed.
Yeah.
You know, when they actually do go and visit.
You know,
with
that
her.
Part's just weird. That part's just weird. I'm sorry. It's just weird.
No, that part is awesome, and they better do it justice in the movie, or I'll be so mad.
I'm sure they will, though.
Well, who brought up this point about the secret keeper and the Fidelia charm?
That was me.
Though?
What kind of throws me off is Lily in her letter talks about how Bathilda Bagshot comes dropping by their house every day, and I'm thinking they're under the Fidelia's charm right now. Peter Pettigrew is supposed to be their secret keeper. Isn't it kind of weird that people can just drop by, even if it's people they trust? Isn't the whole point that it's just one person that knows where they are?
Huh.
These questions just keep coming up. I don't know. It's kind of hard
and then
to
she
answer.
And then she says in the letter, draining. She's like, oh, Sirius, if you could just drop by, I'm sure it would make him much happier.
Yeah, because James is freaking out. James is like Sirius was in book 5. James is feeling lonely and secluded. Yeah. He wants to go out.
Cabin
they
fever.
They didn't leave the house, right?
No.
It's cabin fever.
And I
You're
mean,
right,
she
Micah.
Even says in the letter, she's like, well, Dumbledore still has James's cloak, so it's not like he can even sneak out. So you know that they're under the charm at that point.
That's true. Yeah. And Harry also says, when she mentions Pettigrew being down, Harry says, well, did Pettigrew know that would be the last time he would be seeing them alive and stuff like that? It's like, just really intense. You know they're under the charm and hiding, so why is Bathilda dropping by every second? Couldn't they, in fact, torture Bathilda and find out the whereabouts of James and Lily since she had been there?
The only thing I can think of maybe, is the meeting, like, somewhere in the house that Bathilda could get to. I mean, because realistically, they couldn't possibly just... It couldn't just be them three that whole time they're in hiding. Like, realistically, they'd have to be meeting with other people.
Don't think
how so?
Well, just because... to stay sane, like... I don't know.
Well, they have a family to raise. Plenty of people raise families without any friends nearby.
I'm trying to think if there was a logical answer to this, what it would be.
Well, the question is, did Pettigrew have to tell Bathilda where the Potters were so that she could go and visit them, or what?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, and what else?
Well, she's a neighbor.
Get.
She already knows where they are.
You know, we know that they were located in their home, and Sirius clearly knew that's where they were. Why was it any less of a risk for Sirius not to be their secret keeper if he knew where they were anyway?
Yeah. Yeah, that's awkward because of the way this you're right, because of the way this letter's written, anybody who intercepted the letter to Sirius or anybody could figure out kind of where they were.
Yeah.
You're right. And was the charm destroyed once Pettigrew told Bathilda where they were or what? You know, what happens when somebody you confide in, when the secret keeper tells where something is, does that make it still closed off to the outside world, or what? Or does it break the charm?
It's not a secret, though, anymore.
Yeah.
It's not a secret to... So does the charm break, or what?
I don't know. There are too many questions.
When Peter Pettigrew told Voldemort, do you think Voldemort automatically left as soon as he knew, or do you think that
he
waited?
Oh, this is interesting. I'm just kind of reading this on Harry Potter lexicon. It says, even if one of the Potters had been captured, force-fed Veretta serum, or placed under the Imperius curse, they would not have been able to give away the whereabouts of the other two. The only people who ever knew their precise location were those whom Wormtail had told directly, but none of them would have been able to pass on the information. So it's possible that Sirius and Bathilda knew where they were, but they would never be able to divulge the information if they were captured.
Interesting.
That is interesting.
Though, didn't Jo also change the outcome of how the... On her website, there was an old question, one of the original FAQs, regarding the Fidelia's Charm, and she later, you know, midway into Book 7, said, okay, I've changed my mind, this is what's happening.
This was from her official site, though, because the lexicon has a note as to where the quote came from. So that was from Jo herself.
Yeah, because I think how it happens with everyone... Because what happened with Grimmauld Place was everyone who knew was then in turn a secret keeper.
Right.
Isn't that what she said? But that seems in contradiction with what she had previously said, I think. So she changed her mind and she told everyone about it. I recall that happening. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, this is a big chapter. And kind of how I wanted to start talking about this was, and I mentioned this to Andrew, I think, is how predictable... was this when you guys were reading it? And I know there's so much theory that was out there about it.
Yeah.
Were you kind of disappointed a little bit that it, and I mean, everything was not as I thought it was as far as how it all played out, but the general things, who RAB was, who, you know, went with him to cross the lake, you know, was it all a little bit too, you know, easily figured
everyone
out?
Everyone knew because of how, you know, we had harked on it for so long, you know, and when Lexicon came out with their Arcturus, I think it was. Wasn't it Lexicon who spoiled that? Basically, that Regulus had a... Then everybody pretty much knew...
But even before that, a lot of people thought it was going to be Regulus Black.
Right, right. But then the thing was, the Lexicon got some sort of confirmation by somebody. And at that point, they posted on their site, they posted the whole name. And we even talked about this on the podcast. And then it was knocked down... And apparently Bloomsbury, whoever, said, okay, take it off.
But, I mean, Micah's right. There were – and it struck me as well when reading this that there were actually two moments in this chapter that we already pretty much could have predicted long before Book 7. And so are you asking basically what do we think about how Jo handled the fact that we all knew? So kind of coming out to telling us wasn't really that revolutionary, but yet she still kind of had to write it through so that it made sense?
I think there's a couple of things here. The first being that – with this story coming to an end, there had to be certain things that people could guess and guess right. I mean, you know, Jo is very good at what she does in terms of, you know, hiding little clues along the way. But I think that there are certain things that, you know, you just get to that point and what you guess is going to be right. And this just happened to be one of those things. And I know, you know, I'm not saying I was disappointed in the chapter, but I just thought maybe it was a little bit too predictable.
Well, I kind of like how she gives Regulus quite a bit of humanity. He's not the coward that that Sirius kind of portrayed him to be. And, you know, Sirius didn't like his brother, but you see that human flaw in Sirius then of disliking pretty much anything that has to do with his family, because that's, you know, sort of the character Sirius was. For him to underestimate that his brother actually penetrated Voldemort's defenses so much so... And the reasoning why, I mean, I don't think it discredits anything, because when Creature tells the story of what exactly happened, I was so enthralled by it that, to be honest, I thought it was really cool. And I thought it was fine that Sirius had already, you know, had made a point to tell Harry that his brother was crap or a coward.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't really, I mean, I know that a lot of people... and I think this was before the whole thing with the Lexicon came out, but at one point Jo said on her website, I'm sure a few of you will figure out what one of them is if you've read closely enough. And then everybody, of course, gravitated to that locket, which was a lot like the locket in Half-Blood Prince.
Right.
And then, of course, the initials are RAB, so everyone thinks Regulus Black, regardless of the middle initial.
Of course, because people had already... caught that little mid-sentence of reference to a locket, because she does mention the locket in Book 5, and then Harry, Ron, and Hermione in this book, in this chapter, say, wait, there was a locket. what? Remember we saw Locket? And everybody's like, oh my god, yeah. And that, and J.K. Rowling had referenced that in like the middle of a sentence once before, so I thought that...
Well, and also, everybody pretty much predicted that Mundungus took it, and he ended up being the one who took it, which I just find funny. Just bringing up that Micah is saying that a lot of this was somewhat predictable.
Yeah, you're right. Mundungus
but it's
having
almost,
it.
Yeah. It's almost predictable in the sense that you're just waiting for them to find out, to put the pieces together.
It was more like vindication, kind of, you know, for us. We were like, yes, we knew it. All
vindicated.
Along.
I am self-aware.
But I will give Joe the credit for completely, you know, taking it in a different direction at the end of the chapter, because I did not see that coming at all. And I guess we'll talk about that in a little bit. Where the locket went.
Well, we don't know that yet at the end of the chapter. Well, we don't know who it went to.
Oh, that's the end of the next chapter. Forget it.
Yeah, that's the end of the next chapter.
We don't know who it went
see, this
to
is,
yet.
See, this is what happens when you prepare with two chapters. And
oh,
you
see, I
don't
know you
one.
Did that, man. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's why I started reading the next one, then I was like, better not. I'm just going to get confused.
Yeah. All right, my fault. Anyway.
Yeah, but you're right. You're right, Micah. And when we find out who actually has it, that's messed up. That's really messed up.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interesting point here I wanted to bring up where it says, even though that Regulus changed his mind about Voldemort, he didn't satisfactorily attempt to explain that to Creature or his family before he died, because it says they were safer if sticking to the pureblood line anyway, because there was a prejudice and discrimination against purebloods, or non-purebloods. So, basically, J.K. Rowling's created a situation where Regulus Black, disenchanted from Voldemort, didn't really tell anybody except set out to destroy it and end up sacrificing himself so that he could destroy the locket. And he didn't tell his family that Voldemort didn't have the right idea because, presumably, I mean, that's what Hermione suggests, that it was just safer to be a pureblood and not sort of change your ideas if you were a Muggle hater at that time. Because for the reasons of what we see later on in Book 7, which is all even the ministry officials who are getting taken to court and put on trial for having Muggle husbands or wives or whatever.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting, sort of no-win situation of war and hard times.
Yeah, I wonder what it was that made Regulus change his mind.
Well, wasn't it when he suggested about the elf? Wasn't it when he said, I need an elf? And what he was horrified after Creature told him what he made Creature do.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that that was kind of, well, yeah.
Oh, you're right, though.
I guess
because
that's right.
It said, because Creature says Regulus came to him a few months later then, after he had,
yeah.
And I guess that's sort of after he had figured a little bit more out about what the cave was all about to begin with.
Right. Maybe he just got a better understanding of what was going on and realized, you know what?
Yeah.
Maybe this isn't the right thing for me to be doing, and maybe in the end it's not the best thing for the wizarding community as a whole. But I wanted to talk about...
I mean, he obviously shows
he
compassion.
Does. And so does Creature. What do you guys think about this? This whole chapter is like pity for Creature at the end.
I felt so bad for him.
You really feel horrible. It's like, wow, why do I feel this bad for that stupid elf?
See, he's not stupid, though.
Because he's not stupid. He's totally not. But even the moment when Harry wants to be angry at Creature for selling out Sirius, there's this total reversal where everything everybody else is saying makes perfect sense, and Sirius was just that flawed that he did not treat Creature with respect like everyone else did. And that was his own problem. And Hermione and Dumbledore had always said human beings will always pay for their actions. Yeah. And now they did.
Right. Yeah.
And there's just that
moment. I thought it was very important that Hermione said that. Like you were saying, Eric, you know, wizards will pay for the way they treated house elves, and so did Sirius.
Yeah.
And at that point, I remember reading it originally. I was like, oh man, Harry's going to like deck her.
He's just going to be like,
you know, he's going to kill her. Yeah.
Hermione, can I see you?
But. And I thought it was important that Harry kind of remarked that he felt like he should object or something along those lines.
But he had nothing to say.
But when he thought about it, there was really nothing to say because it was true.
Yeah, I like that moment a lot. So I like Creature. I think Joe did the right thing with this whole chapter. I thought it was really cool.
I like that line in particular where, you know, Harry was thinking to himself, how could Voldemort have made such a mistake? You know, and that goes back to what Laura was saying.
Of leaving Creature there to die. When house elves have a different magic that would have allowed them to escape.
The thing, this scene in the movie would have been butchered if they continue with the cutting.
I can't wait to see
this. Oh, I'm so glad she told them not to cut it.
The cave scene. I cannot wait to see it.
Oh, so excited.
Sorry. But yeah, they're going to have to sort of, now in movie 7, they're going to have Creature back at that cave. I think they should. I think they should cast a Regulus Black. I think they should. It could be cool.
It was very uplifting, though, to see Creature side with Harry and Ron and Hermione. I mean, he, you know, he had to, but at the same time, I sort of got a sense like he was on their team. He was on their side. Like
he just appreciates he wanted to being work appreciated. With
them. Yeah, and it was nice reading so... that. It felt uplifting.
Yeah. And well, at the very end, when Creature sets off, you know, he gives a low bow to Harry and Ron, the other wizard, and kind of does a little nudge or something in the direction of Hermione, like a little jerk,
it's like a little jerk or something,
to Hermione, which is like, you know, so funny. You really love that guy. You love the elf. He just wants to be appreciated. So that was all cool.
And to mention the movies real quick, this chapter really is the reason why. He was in Order of the Phoenix, because remember there was that whole debate over a Creature was left in there.
Yes.
I think it was Haman who revealed that he was left in there just because Joe said so. Joe said he plays an important role in Seven, so
precisely.
I would recommend
and it's because
keep it
he
in
knows
five.
The whereabouts of one of the seven Horcruxes. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes, indeed.
Well, it's time for quote quiz. Hold on,
Andrew. That was horrible.
Yeah, there wasn't enough echo.
That
was horrible.
Where was the echo?
It's time for quote quiz. So the quote today is, of course, from chapter 11, The Bribe. And it doesn't seem likely they were just strolling down Tottenham Court Road at the time, does it? Said.
Wait, that's not a quote if you include said.
Well, it's a quote from the book. So, all right, so that's a quote quiz. We're going to do a segment now we haven't done in a while, and the reason we're bringing it back today, other than the demand for some older segments, by the way, might make the connection, would have been on here today, but Jamie wasn't here, so we'll try to do them whether Jamie's on or not, because Jamie's back in school now, so it's a little harder for him to record.
But he comes out with the most outrageous connections you could possibly
that's
think
why,
of.
That's why it's
the beauty.
It's funny, too, to think that he's just sitting there and making them up, too.
It is.
So this favorite, back when... Matt Britton was just a mere fanboy of the show. He told me the other day he actually emailed in a favorite submission. He said it was his one email to the show, but then I searched his name and there were a few. But anyway.
it's a lie. Just a liar.
It's just all the Matt Britton posers out there.
Yeah, I guess. Everyone's PS Lefty at 11 Natalie.
No, it was all his transcript submissions.
Yeah. Because you guys talk over each other, I can't hear a word you're saying.
Matt, what was your favorite submission back way long ago?
Okay, yeah. Well, that was when you guys just started favorites. I thought it was an awesome thing. So, I'm a huge soundtrack fan. So, I was curious what your guys' opinions was for your favorite song off the Potter series soundtrack.
Now, Matt's a big.
No, what was your favorite theme
Matt,
song?
Matt's a big. Soundtrack fan, so he holds the segment very near and dear to his heart. I would have to say my favorite, and I've always stuck with this one just because it always run through my head and it was a perfect fit in the trailer, from Chamber of Secrets, The Dueling Club. And that's in the scene where Harry and Draco are dueling in the dueling club. And it was just the movements on screen went along with the music. It was like, if I remember correctly, it wasn't exactly to the music, but they moved to the music a little bit, it seemed. At least with their steps and everything. So
what it was too, the snare drum was just awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just absolutely awesome.
So Eric, what was your favorite?
Yeah, The Dueling Club.
Oh, same.
From Chambers. Well, see, what I did is I went through sort of my memory of the first movie and obviously the rest of them, and I tried to pick out my favorite one from each, and then I figured, well, one out of those five, which is my favorite, and I said The Dueling Club. And you're right, and it's basically, like, it's very similar to the Gilderoy Lockhart theme, except with the drums and the sort of militaristic sort of tone to it. So, yeah, The Dueling Club's my favorite, but... since you already said that, I just have to go with Hedwig's theme.
You're so predictable.
It's a cop-out.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, well, a cop-out? Okay, well, I have two. I can't decide between Professor Umbridge or the Room of Requirements for five. Movie four is Neville's Waltz. Movie three is the Nick Bus. You know, what else are you going to do?
That's good, though. I thought that's a good choice, I guess. I mean, it's everyone's favorite. Laura?
Well, I have to say, I mean, I enjoyed... if I had to pick a soundtrack, I enjoyed the Prisoner of Azkaban one the most, but there is one song that sticks out in my mind in particular, and I have to just say that I've always hated this song. I thought it was the dumbest song I'd ever heard in my life. It's Can You Dance Like a Hippogriff? But there's a very good memory that goes with this. I don't know, Andrew, Matt, if you guys remember.
Yes,
but
I was going to
say. Me, now I remember. Everson, Elisa, like a whole group of us at the ball at Prophecy all stood in a circle and danced to that freaking song.
Is it Do the Hippogriff by the Wheel?
Yes.
Do the Hippogriff. I remember too, Laura, at that whole convention on Prophecy, you kept mentioning if they play
dance that like a
hippogriff,
song.
Do the hippogriff, I will shank somebody.
I did, and then they played
wait,
it at
you
the end.
Someone?
I knew they would.
No, but you were so excited though. I was surprised. I was waiting for like this violent reaction from you, but all you did was freak out and start dancing.
Yeah.
Well, I was very excited that night.
It was fun.
It was very fun. Good times.
Micah, how about you?
I was a big fan of the music in Order of the Phoenix, and I liked I think it was called Fireworks.
The first song?
When the Weasley twins were exiting. You know, and they basically smashed all those proclamations and Umbridge is running around.
It's a great scene. I can see why you
like
it.
I actually used that song.
I thought the guitar solo, too, was really awesome in that song.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually,
you're right.
That music in the beginning of the show a couple months back underneath one of
for
the ads. Yeah,
an ad or something?
Yeah. I remember that. So. It was Fireworks is great. It's really well. Like, I just really like Nicholas Hooper's score for the fifth movie. If I had to say favorite soundtrack, it might be Five. It actually might be, which is closely followed by Chamber of Secrets, though. You know, because Chamber of Secrets was really good. Because coming with, I don't own the first movie soundtrack. Do any of you guys?
Yes.
Really?
I don't. Yeah.
Could you burn it and send it to me? Because on it, like, I don't remember there being, like, I forget all the names. I never learned them, you know, of the first Harry movie soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first soundtrack has a lot of horns and French horns and.
A lot of French horns?
Yeah, and things. But you'll just have to listen to it.
Because that's what I really like about John Williams is his ability to build on what he's already done and sort of create different, you know, different themes and different moods. And it was just all good. It was all good. So I owned the Chamber of Secrets one with Harry on the front, and I own the other one with Dumbledore. I think I got a Dumbledore one, too, with Richard Harris as Dumbledore. So that was cool. Because, you know, they made the five different covers for it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool.
So, Matt, what is your favorite?
Well, my favorite theme comes from the Prisoner of Azkaban soundtrack, which is definitely my favorite soundtrack of the five so far, because John Williams pretty much changed all the theme songs from the Harry Potters. He just came up with a whole new score for the series. So my favorite would be entitled A Window to the Past.
Yeah, that was a really good one.
Because every time they played it in the film, it just fit whatever the dialogue was so beautifully.
Yeah,
I remember this. This is nice flute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very.
It just makes me think of Harry and Sirius and Harry and Remus. It just fits, you know, the whole part of them connecting to Harry's parents.
Yeah, and it was very.
And it
calming.
Has a little clip of Hedwig's theme in the middle of the song, but it's kind of like a bittersweet song. That's why I like it.
Well, we're just about finished today, but before we wrap up, we have a chicken soup. Matt, you want to read it?
Sure. This chicken soup for the Mulcastle comes from Melanie, 16, from San Antonio, Texas, and she writes, "Hey guys, since it's a new year and the holidays are over, I felt it necessary to take some time to let you guys know just how wonderful you are. Each week I hear all the different people who tell you how you've helped them through difficult times, and each week I'm thankful for what I like to call my weekly hour and a half of pure joy. This week is first semester finals week at my school, and so far is a more intense form of stress that I have ever been under before. In fact, most of my friends actually call it dead week. I am in a bunch of advanced classes and have killer exams, and I have practiced for the school musical until around 6 every night. Wow. The past few nights I found myself studying until around 3 or 4 in the morning. I can't remember a time in my life when I have ever been this stressed, but through all these crazy Dr. Pepper-filled nights, I have found joy, as usual, and relaxation in listening to past and current episodes of MuggleCast. Your witty comments and funny jokes make me laugh and keep me awake and entertained while I study in the wee hours of the morning. So I would just like to thank you all for helping me survive exam week and also for giving me my weekly hour and a half of pure joy. Thanks again for all of you have done for me. Melanie.
That's awesome.
Oh, that's sweet.
Aww.
All those crazy Dr. Pepper-filled nights.
If she's that's looking awesome. For more pure joy, I would recommend hairspray.
Hairspray.
No, Sweeney Todd.
Yeah, that's pure joy.
That's pure blood and a little bit of...
You'll enjoy watching it. I don't know if what's happening is enjoyable.
Depends on what kind of a person you are.
I think that does it for... this week's episode of MuggleCast. Next week, I just want to give everyone a little teaser. I did an interview today with Freddie Highmore, who is starring in Spiderwick Chronicles. He's the guy who played the kid in the chocolate movie. Charlie Bucket.
Wow, that's very specific. How about he played Charlie?
And also that movie with the little people.
He played Charlie Bucket in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the remake with Johnny Depp, and he also was recently in August Rush, and I interviewed him earlier today. It was a good interview, and he talked a little bit about Harry Potter and all that, so he'll be on the show next week, and then 2 weeks from that show, he'll be on again for an interview. We're going to split into a two. So let's remind everyone about our contact information before we wrap up today. Laura, if I want to send a pickle object to the pickle object box, where do I deliver it?
Don't send pickles.
That's what PO stands for, pickle object. Remember last week?
She's warning
please
you
send,
right now.
Please send all of your parcel mail that does not include anything pickle related to PO Box 3151, Cumming, Georgia 30028.
Keep in mind our new catchphrase is gold box. You can also call in a MuggleCast voicemail. We're going to get back to them soon. I promise. I'm sorry. I keep saying that and then we don't. We are going to get back to it soon. In the United States, you can dial 1-218-20-MAGIC. If you're in the United Kingdom, you can dial 020-8144-0677. And if you're in Australia, you can dial 02-800-35668. Just remember to keep your question under 60 seconds and eliminate as much background noise as possible before you call. You can also call us via Skype, our Skype name, which is MuggleCast, and just leave a voicemail. You can also visit MuggleCast.com for a handy feedback form to contact any one of us. You can also use our first name at staff.mugglenet.com, except for Matt, who is Matthew B. at staff.mugglenet.com. And also, do not forget our community outlets. You know, I always say it week to week, you know, roll through it and, you know, it's no big deal. But seriously, check out our MySpace at myspace.com/MuggleCastFans. You can also check out our Facebook. We have YouTube group, a Frapper group, Last.fm group, and the fan listing and the forums are exploding right now with new members every day. There's been lots of good discussions on there. I know Eric, Laura, Matt, and I have all been answering questions on the forum. So if you want to get some more MuggleCast, sort of. At least more of the host.
Are you saying that I don't answer questions?
Are you even a member?
It was really a way of saying, pretty much.
Yeah, so...
No, I've made some posters there a few times.
I have, guys, I am so backlogged, I have, 33 questions to answer. So, it's
pretty intense. The forums are thriving, so check them out today to discuss MuggleCast and everything else.
It's MuggleCastFan.net/forums.
Forums, yeah, cool. Also, dig the show at dig.com. Like we said at the beginning, vote for us once a month at Podcast Alley. And then don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes and Yahoo Podcasts. And lastly, do not forget that we have a listener poll on MuggleCast.com to see if we can do this tour or not. We would love to have, a few hundred people come out to each tour stop, but realistically, we'll probably have between 100 and 200 at each stop. So please go and vote so we know where to go this tour. We do want to keep it within those five locations, though. I don't think we'll be going any further north or
south. Is Richmond on that poll?
Yes, Richmond's on the poll.
Okay, cool. Awesome.
So,
One more thing. For next week, Chapter 11, make sure to send in emails or voicemails regarding Chapter 11. We obviously want your feedback from Chapter 10, but it's also good to have some of your ideas, as we're going through the chapter. So send in stuff for both chapter 10 and 11 for next week.
Okay, cool.
And chapter 11 is called The Bride.
Yes. Yeah. All right, so that does it for this week's episode of MuggleCast. Once again, I'm Andrew Sims.
I'm Eric Skull.
I'm Laura Thompson.
I'm Mike Attenabell.
And I'm Matt Britton.
You sound so uncertain. I'm Matt Britton.
I am Ron Burgundy.
Is that my name?
We will see everyone next week for episode 129. Bye-bye.
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 Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. Are we pressing stop now?
Chapter 10, Creature's
Tail.
Creatures what?
Is that what it says? Creature, like, hold shit. On.
Okay.
Laura, is that your dog?
No, that wasn't mine.
No, that was
mine.
Matt
was barking earlier.
Matt, you better watch out because there's a Terminator nearby. Because dogs don't like Terminators. That's when they bark. It means
the
Terminator's
near. Oh, have you been watching that? Is that not
the
best show ever?
Yes, it's pretty good.
It's
I'm impressed.
Good.
Yeah, Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles,
I
Monday
night
at 9.
But it was actually quite good.
Oh, but it was so good.
Yeah.
Shut up, Matt.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
I hate you.
Right.
Okay.
Dude, you really have a Terminator in your... Seriously, man, like...
It's probably my brother.
You're the Terminator.
Your brother is a Terminator.
One second.
What is going on?